Hello, this is Bill Curley.
And Holly Hudley.
And welcome to the podcast In Between, which is an educational offering of
St. Paul's United Methodist Church and Ordinary Life.
Okay, let's talk about synchronicity.
Okay. I think we call that synchronous silence.
Well, I just thought I would kick this off with some surprise. I didn't know it was going to upset your tickle box, as they say.
Okay. My dad used to play this game with us when we were little, where he would sit us on his knees and we would be facing him. And he would kind of bounce us on his knees and go real slow. 1, 2, 3. And he'd drop us between, he'd open his knees and we'd sort of fall down between his knees and it would make us giggle. So we would say, we want to play the tickle box game.
And that was it.
Yeah. He would turn our tickle box upside down is what we called it. So, yeah. Mm.
So the synchronicity was that you sent me a text this morning saying that you, what was the context about having a daily spiritual practice?
Oh, I've never heard anyone say that, first of all. So it is really something about a daily spiritual practice. I sent you a text yesterday evening. And that said, so you were either in my office or in my head in my office today. I said out loud to someone, have you considered a daily spiritual practice? And you said, well, that's funny. It's in the beginning of the sermon I'm working on.
Yeah, I'm preaching in the big church here on the 28th. And yesterday I had, during the night, I was hit with this inspiration. And the inspiration is the sermon beginning by saying that one of the ways that people in this church poke fun at me, and it is a well-deserved poke, is about my insistence that people have a daily spiritual practice.
Yes.
And that it has gotten to the point that I don't even have to say the thing. I just started and the whole class begins. Have a daily spiritual practice because they're getting sick and tired of hearing about it.
Yeah.
But I'm not relenting on that or turn signals.
Well, turn signals. My son, my middle son, because he also knows that about you, about turn signals somehow. Every time I don't use my turn signal, he goes, Mom, use your turn signal. And your relentless mention is a little too casual of a daily spiritual practice has changed my life because the practice has, you know, I was just having a conversation with a much younger person than I, who's in a lot of anxiety and about life and what do I do? And we were talking about cultivating patience and presence, and she said, how do I do that? And I said, well, again, a daily practice is really helpful. And for a long time, when I started a daily practice, you know, I used to go, I must be doing this wrong. I'm doing this wrong because my mind won't stop thinking and my brain won't stop, you know, just the kind of chatter. So a lot of it was like sitting with my own thoughts. Mm-hmm. And now I just kind of see all of it as play. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's funny. I'm having that worry thought again. Or mm-hmm. I also play a lot in spiritual practice. Like sometimes it's movement. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's music oriented. Like I'll put on some sound in the background without any lyrics and just kind of work with that. Let whatever surface. So it's like the way it's working on me is to help me be so much less self-judgmental mm-hmm. and critical.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Because you begin to identify more with the witness than with the nonsense that our culture says that you are. Does that make sense?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
I'm seeing a man for spiritual direction who said to me, like 3 or 4 weeks ago, he said, our world would be in a much better place. Pardon me, much better place if everybody had a daily spiritual practice. I wish I had known about this earlier. That is not the usual thing, but I think most people resist having a practice.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about how I got into this. My own personal story would have a lot to do with growing up with an incredible amount of anxiety in my family of origin and not being able to identify the sorts of that and all that sort of thing, which led me to the study of psychology.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Yeah, and so along the way, I've had, as you've heard me say a bunch of times, these great teachers. And one of them was a philosophy of religion professor who was a Quaker. And he talked about the fact that if you really want to have the benefits of the things that we talk about at something other than an intellectual level, you have to have a daily spiritual practice.
Yeah.
And that made sense to me. But I was in a tradition that didn't, at the time, didn't teach it. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know how to go about doing that. There was no Jim Finley, Richard Rohr. There was no centering prayer. There was no Thomas Keating. I had not been introduced to Buddhism yet. So I just didn't know any of that. I just sort of felt my way along.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, that's a very experiential thing, you know, to kind of feel your way along for a head type, right? To kind of feel into it. I have found, you know, I think one of the misconceptions of a daily practice is that it's somehow separate from the rest of our day. Yes, it is carved out time. And what I have found is that that carved out time begins to impact every other moment in the day. I catch myself easier. It doesn't mean I don't become angry. You've heard some stories. It doesn't mean I don't have, you know, the whatever it is, my human self. It's that I can like more readily enter into that inner observer space rather than be captured by the moment. And I just, you know how sometimes you do something for a long time and you don't really know if it's working. You're just kind of like, well, I hope it's working. And then one day you kind of look back over a decade and you go, I'm so much less anxious than I used to be.
Yeah. That's the way it works.
Yeah.
You would not, I've got a couple of metaphors about it. You would not expect somebody who hopes to be a concert pianist to think that they could accomplish that goal by just going to a lesson once a week. Nor would you think that after 3 months of diligent practice, they could be a concert pianist.
Yeah.
Unless they're a prodigy.
Yeah.
I saw a show on PBS last week about prodigies, an 11-year-old who'd written a symphony.
Holy wow.
Yeah. And he played it for some violin virtuoso, like not a cello, like Yo-Yo Ma, and they played together, an 11-year-old.
That's so
and
beautiful.
Yo-Yo Ma. Yeah. Oh, it was really moving. But anyway, I'm not a prodigy, so I have to practice.
It's a cool prodigy. You know, I mean, you gotta, that child, that 11-year-old, I guarantee to you, practices every day.
Yeah.
That didn't just come out of dream state, you know. But that prodigy already has cultivated a practice, you know. What a gift to have had that at a young age. And
we're attendees of the Houston Symphony. And Houston Symphony is a good symphony, by the way.
Yeah.
As symphonies go. And our principal cello player was a featured soloist about two performances ago. He is, as so many of our symphony players are, on the faculty of the Shepherd School of Music at Rice. And I could go down that rabbit hole about how wonderful they are and what excellent musicians they produce. But this guy entered the University of Arizona when he was 12.
I would be nowhere near emotionally prepared to enter a university setting at age 12.
Maybe he was not in some areas of his life, like socially or financial independence or something like that. But with his talent, he was.
Yeah.
And his talent was not music.
Yeah. Huh.
His talent was math.
Really?
But
math and music have such a
He wanted to pursue music, so he left that. But he did it. He's an incredible, incredible musician.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to having a daily spiritual practice. What did your client say?
I have tried it out, and I said, "Well, a lot of the things that we are talking about in here will start to make sense when you really spend time with them. Or we can just do this once a week and, you know, it'll take longer for it to really sink in." I'm trying to cultivate this like line between, you know, I'm trained as a counselor. I'm not an LPC, but I have been trained as a counselor and worked as a school mental health counselor. And I'm trained as a spiritual director. And there's a thin line that often is very erasable between these two practices. Do you find that to be true also?
I find that everything that I do is connected to spirit.
Yeah. That's the like compass, right? Like that's the true north.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I will have maybe because of where my office is located and my history in doing this. But let's say even before I was in this physical location, I would say what I just said, that I have been guided by that quote by Jung that you've heard till you want to throw up about how our resolution of difficulty is spiritual. Mm-hmm. And I believe that for, you know, all this time. So even if someone came in and they weren't speaking a spiritual language and didn't have spiritual metaphors, I still thought that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm starting to wonder if there can be a thing called, you know, there's depth psychology and there's spiritual direction. I'm starting to wonder if there's a thing called that we can call depth spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is that braided space between what happens in the mind and what happens in the body or in the spirit, you know.
When I was getting acquainted with Sister Lois, my spiritual director, and was telling her part of my history, was that one time I taught this class called Mind and Spirit because my goal was to connect spirituality and psychology. And she said, "Whatever made you think they were separate?"
She's so like direct with you. I love it.
She misses no.
Yeah. I should announce that we're having a guest appearance right in this moment. My 15-month-old dog has her face in the screen and was licking my cheek. She says hello.
You know the comic strip Pearls Before Swine?
You've shared some of it before, but that's how I know it. Yeah.
There's this theology professor in the cartoon who is reading this kid's paper. And the question on the paper is, Define Heaven. And the paper reads, Heaven is where all the dogs I've ever known come and lick my face forever. And the professor says, I think I have to give him a passing grade.
Heck yeah. There was this beautiful video once. It was probably on some social media, Instagram or something like that, about a little boy who had quite a traumatic life and had been in foster care and just not really ever formed a safe attachment. And he was receiving pet therapy and he was handed a puppy and the puppy was just squirming and licking and squirming and licking and squirming and licking. And the little boy is just crying. And the person kind of administering this pet therapy says, what's the matter? Are you okay? And he just said, it just feels so good. To be loved.
Yeah. Hope the kid got to keep the dog.
I hope so too. They are so healing. They really are.
Yeah. So you want to talk about now using your turn signals, or you want to go back to talking about spiritual practice?
Well, one of my spiritual practices is poetry, which I've shared with you. One of my spiritual practices is also being interrupted by my dogs and just being open to that moment. It keeps happening. And I read a poem that just made me think of kind of the whole purpose of ordinary life, actually. And yeah. It's a poem by Mary Oliver, the patron saint of everything. But let me read it and you just tell me how you respond to it. Every day I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations of life. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the oceans shine, the prayers that are made of grass.
That's gorgeous. That's beautiful. What book is that in, of hers?
Devotions. And it's just a collection, but it's they're all written over time. It is just the ordinariness.
Yeah.
And I think what you've been teaching us, obviously, as the class is so named, is just delight in ordinary life. Mm-hmm. That alone is a spiritual practice. How might we find delight in the blade of grass, or delight in the way a child laughs or cries or throws things when he's mad?
It's hard to find delight at the moment.
I find rage, but but then, I mean, look what I'm doing now. I'm finding humor in the anger, you know? I mean, it's like, oh, that too. May that too serve awakening, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, you know, all I can say is that it works, right? Like this cultivation of a practice,
mm-hmm.
this, I will never forget. I don't know if you said this in class or if you said it to me directly or both. When you said once, you know, we can dig 10 wells 10 feet deep, or we can dig one well 1,000 mm-hmm. feet deep, and that's where all the waters mm-hmm. run together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like that feels truer than true to me now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is not an original idea with me. I heard that from the great scholar of religion, Warford Smith, I think. So I think it's just not an original line with me. You dig one well 60 feet deep, not 10 wells 6 feet deep.
Yeah.
Which is, he said that, I think, and if I'm quoting the right person, I may have to go back and correct it. He said that in response to what was going on in the 60s when Buddhism did get introduced in the United States and everybody was dropping out and flower power and all that sort of stuff going on. And people were putting together religions like a patchwork quilt. They're taking a little bit from astrology and a little bit from the Kabbalah and a little bit from, you know, this and that and that, and then calling that a religion. And he was saying, you can't do that. I mean, you need to find a path and stay with it and mine it for all it's worth. And you can have conversations with people who've dug other wells.
Yeah.
But you'll do better. And you know, Holly, I have found, and I don't mean to be immodest about this, I think that probably the last couple of years I've done the best teaching I've done because I'm mining stuff deeper and deeper, that it's the same thing, but at much deeper levels than I've ever gone.
That's the spiral stair, right?
Yeah.
This,
yeah.
And
that
I,
is the spiral staircase.
It's funny because like what he's saying is both true and not true, because the deeper we go in that well, the more I'm like, oh, this mysticism sure sounds a lot like this mysticism.
Right.
You know, and so the mining of the deeper and deeper well, where it all bleeds together, is actually, yeah, there's a little bit of everything in everything.
Well, what Joseph Campbell and what Carl Jung would say is that by going deep, you get to the collective.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in these wonderful myths that religion is, are the same quote unquote teachings. Mm-hmm. I don't want to flatten them and say, like, it's not same, but it's essentially about, I mean, gosh, the thing that the one that also stands out the most to me is that when you pull forth what is within you will save you. And if what is within you is a path toward the Kabbalah or a path toward Christian mitzvahs, you know, like what you pull forth will save you. And I kind of believe in the heart of hearts, we're all ordinary mystics, you know, that we are all capable of delighting in the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And that alone can become a holy practice.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buddhist idea of like, well, what do you do when you get enlightenment? Well, if you were cutting wood and carrying water before, you go back to cutting wood and carrying water. Mm-hmm. But you do it with new eyes, mm-hmm. you know? Mary Oliver looked at blades of grass probably since she was a small child. But she never stopped. And so she never stopped being amazed by what that blade of grass had to offer, you know? Mm-hmm. And that amazement seemed over her lifetime to have deepened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm. So somebody who might take up a practice of Vipassana meditation to pay attention to breathing would say, I can't do this because I'm distracted by my thoughts. That's so wonderful,
mm-hmm.
because you begin to have a chance to see that you're noticing your thoughts. You're not your thoughts.
Yes. 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 Yeah.
And when you get into that space, you've entered the space of the mystic.
That's what James Finley says, right? Is the number of times that you get distracted is how many opportunities you have for return.
Yeah.
And that's so, like, there's so much grace in that. There's so much spaciousness in that. Because
mm-hmm.
of the condemning voice that says, oh, bad, I got distracted. There goes that thinking brain. Whoop, mm-hmm. there's a chance to return, you know?
Right. And to do it without judgment.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I should come up with a definition of spiritual practice, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
I was being a smarty.
You were? Yeah. I couldn't tell. Oh, goodness.
You know, if I didn't do, I mean, I have become over the years more, much more of a morning person. I get up and I have my time, and I don't have three teenage boys at home.
I can give you some. I can change that for you.
I
They
have a
are for rent.
balcony. So anyway, I relish that time. I mean, just to be alone and to do what my practice is, which involves a lot of different things, but writing my dreams and sometimes writing journal entries, but just being still. It's, I think, important.
I think this idea that there is a right way to do it, it's kind of like, okay, I'm going to liken this to learning how to be an artist. Excuse me. I did have to learn skills. I did have to learn how to use the tools and how to shade and how to draw from life. I was classically trained as an artist. And when I learned all those rules, then I can start to make my own way, And that's the same with meditation. It's like you learn some tools. And now I just have this kind of, I said that earlier, this playful way of engaging with, like, well, I think I'll do poetry and maybe some whale sounds today, or, I'll do a collage today and then,
I think it's the same with everything. It's the same with rhetoric. You have to know the rules in order to break them, to be able to do that. By the way, I was going to ask you when you said that, did you ever read a book by Julia Cameron called The Artist Way?
I did, and last year with a friend of mine, co-facilitated a year-long workshop working through the artist way.
You did? I didn't know that.
I did it with my friend Brittany, who's a licensed clinical social worker, and she has a private practice, and we did a once a month where we would kind of hold a little process group, and then we would do an art practice after that. And I would, and myself and Brooke Summers Perry would facilitate the art practice. So it was lovely because I read The Artist's Way when I was in my 20s, so 20 something years ago. Read it, fine, that's great, put it away, then took it back out last year. And I didn't, and this is my rebellious spirit a little bit. I didn't follow it prescriptively. But I already have a practice of waking up and just writing for pages my dreams. And so that writing is to get something out without being protective of grammar or scratch outs or whether it's said right or wrong. It's just getting it out, right? And then going back and you get to work with it later. So that became my daily writing practice, or that was my daily writing practice during the time of this year-long work with The Artist's Way. But it's a great book. I
I
mean,
cannot believe that you and I have talked every at least once a week, and I didn't know you were doing that.
I bet there's things I don't know about you too.
I was not aware that you were doing that. When you said 20 years ago, it's been that long when the book came out, right?
Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, I think it
I
was.
maybe longer than that, because I remember that I had one of these experiences where somebody came up to me and said, "Have you read this book called The Artist's Way?" And I said, "No, I haven't. Thank you." And she said, "Well, I think you'd like it." So then, like the next day, somebody else came and said, "Hey, there's a book I think you would like called The Artist's Way." And I said, "Well, thank you very much. Somebody just told me about that." And then I went out of town to lead a retreat. And one of the retreatants came up and said, "I have a gift for you. It's The Artist's Way." And I said to the universe, "I got the message.
I get
I
it.
will read the damn book." Okay.
Thanks.
And I did. I read it. I started in it, and then I thought, this is a good program.
So I've just been going through with my spiritual direction cohort that kind of there's a similar awakening in many religious traditions, but in the Christian tradition, it's called the threefold path, where, and some call it, you know, spiritual emergence or spiritual emergency, like someone experiences an awakening, goes through a phase of like purging and negating, almost like depriving the senses. So you have this awakening, it's a peak moment. And then following that peak moment is very often a deep depression, because we can't stay in the peak moment, and we kind of get sad that we can't stay in the peak moment. And then following the deep depression is integration, trying to align the awakening into our life, maybe achieving some aha moment, like God is in everything and everything is in God. And then finally, we integrate these new values into our beliefs and actions. You know, this experience gets integrated into our life in a way that there is no separate other. And but one of my points was the purgation, the purge. Like, there's many ways to do that every day. And I think this, for me, is why I have come to value writing my dreams so much, is like just the kind of purgation, if you will, of getting something out, so that there's not only space for something new, but you also get to, you know, whatever happens, you know, when things, I love going back to my dreams and going, oh, that's a repeating element. Like, something's really trying to surface here. Something's really trying to get my attention, you know? And so this purge, I think, is both a macro and a micro process. And we can do it every day by, in her and Julia Cameron's way, by just writing, doing the three pages every single day, you know?
This, for some reason, I'm having a connection that may not make sense to you, but I want to share it. The bridge that I will use to get there is this. Jung said, pardon me, if you don't tell the world who you are, it will tell you. One of the values of having a spiritual practice is that you get to tell the world who you are. And you're driven to make that kind of exploration.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Somebody recommended to me the movie that won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film, called The Zone of Influence. And Holly, I want to recommend it to people with the caveat that there's nothing violent in the movie overtly. But it is a movie about what happens when you don't say to the world who you are. The movie, and this is not ruining anything to tell anybody about, the movie is about the commandant and his family who live next to Auschwitz.
Oh, wow. What's the name of it again?
The Zone of Influence.
Okay.
And it's about this family that is immersed in a culture where all of these things are going on that they are able to ignore. And the metaphors that pop up, I watch the movie and I think about it almost every day, because there were just little flicks of, oh, that's what that meant. Oh, that's a metaphor for something. And I think what happened to those people was that they were so focused on themselves and their own well-being that they were able ostensibly to shut out the world, ostensibly. But of course, in the end, it got them.
Yeah.
You'll see the movie.
Is it, okay, I just looked it up. Is it called The Zone of Interest?
I thought it was Influence.
Okay. This one that comes up is a German movie, The Zone of Interest, in 2023. And it looks like what you're
saying.
Yeah,
that's it. I missed it. Yeah. I misspoke. It's a zone of interest. Yeah,
I'll put it in the notes to the podcast. What you're making me think of is that our So a practice involves intention, attention, and attitude, right? And for all intents and purposes, the Nazis had an intention and paid attention to it. But their attitude was myopic and singular and ego-based, fear-based. And when our intention and attention get hijacked by something that is myopic like this, right? Single-sided. We're not tapping into the sort of larger mind, that connective tissue, the waters that all run together. And yet their intention and attention was singular. And they went deep into that singular attention. But
it's happening in our, the point of the movie is it's happening right now in our culture.
Absolutely.
In our culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
By 20, let's see, this is 2024, right? By 2040, there will be no ethnic majority in the United States. Is that the prediction?
Yeah, it may even be sooner. I can't remember what the exact year is, but it's
And the old white guys who are running the system want to keep the other out. I mean, we've got this politics of hatred toward the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's what the movie is about.
Yeah, I think that's a really good and important point to make when talking about going deeply and myopically into a singular thing. Because there's a shadow side to all things, right? Like that's going deeply into a kind of fundamentalism, right?
Yeah.
And so what's
to follow the law, right?
Right.
To get the rules right. Want to get the rules right. In the spiritual sphere, what's the fundamental rule?
Yeah. We'll love another as you love yourself. That's it.
That's it. And so in the classic story where the rule keeper said, oh, I got it. Okay. All right. I got it. All right. Now, who is that person I'm to love?
Yeah.
It's called the story of the Good Samaritan.
Right.
And our culture is building walls instead of bridges. I know that's a trite line, but.
But we're actually putting saw blades in rivers instead of bridges.
Yeah.
You know,
I really encourage people to see the movie. I think we watched it on Prime. But it's really, really worth doing. Now, here's a question between now and our next podcast. I put this to a person that I'm seeing for spiritual direction, and they said, I disagree with that. And I thought, well, how can you disagree with me? Because I'm always right.
So that caveat aside, we're going to have a pretend argument about whether you're right.
By the way, big parenthesis here. Melinda Owen is going to allow me to interview her in Ordinary Life this week.
Oh, great.
Oh, I love her. She's just a ball of fire. And we fight all the time about several really important things.
I like that.
Whether Patrick Mahomes is better than Tom Brady. That's one. And the other is whether I'm always right.
Okay. And, all right.
All right. Yeah. All right. So back to the serious question. I said, building on the work of the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, that the solution to our problem is education. That if we were educated to know who our neighbor is, that would be a huge step towards solving the problem. And the person that I'm seeing for spiritual direction said, I disagree with that.
And did this person have an alternative answer? Or were they feeling skeptical about the education system?
They were feeling skeptical about the fact that my and I borrowed this from those two people, left it at a theoretical level. He said, you can teach people that they are to love their neighbor, and the neighbor is somebody that they don't like or live next to or in somewhat. But that doesn't solve the problem. They can intellectually agree with that. What solves the problem is learning to live with that person.
Yeah, so that to me is like how I understand Jung's individuation process. You know, it goes through these steps of like a catharsis, elucidation, education, and transformation. Mm-hmm. And education very often happens here. Look at my little emoji. but the education is a head level thing, right? It happens. It's theoretical, as you say.
That's
but
what
it's
my director
necessary.
Was saying.
Yeah. And it's necessary, yeah. Right? The education, and then this is my little reform of what Jung says, the education deepens into the heart, and that's elucidation. And then it comes outward in our actions, and that's transformation. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to like you to love you. Like, I don't have to agree with your politics or with what you have for breakfast in order to love you as a human being.
And my directee was saying that love can, if you leave that love at a theoretical level, you don't get anywhere.
Yeah.
You can, you know, oh, the Israelis really love the Palestinian. They know that, so they should love them, but
yeah.
They still bomb them, you know, but.
Yeah, I think we need some like action steps to love. Like, here's what love looks like in a really pragmatic way, you know? Yeah. And again, I do not have to like you in order to do loving things in your best interest, even if you don't accept them, you know?
There was this guy who said all these great things about loving your neighbor.
Was his name Jesus?
You stole my material.
Oh, sorry. I gave away the punchline.
Well, what I was going to say is that he didn't just say that in words. He said, come on, let's go get some Tex-Mex together. Let's sit down and get a beer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the establishment got really upset.
That's when they got mad. Yeah.
Yeah, that's when they got mad. You're
Yeah.
Having dinner with who?
Yeah. They were like, this was only supposed to be theoretical, man.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh,
so anyway.
Yeah.
So in 2 weeks, you're going to teach Ordinary Life because I'm going to be preaching.
Yes.
And I want to tell you that one of the texts that is assigned for that Sunday is one that most church going people have heard about, the Ethiopian eunuch who was encountered by Philip. Mm. Remember, you know that story?
Yes. But you're going to have to tell it because I can't remember all the parts.
Well, there's this Ethiopian eunuch who is coming back from Jerusalem, and he's in his chariot. He's a very rich person, got access to a lot of wealth. And Philip encounters him, and the eunuch is reading the book of Isaiah, which is a parable. There was no book of Isaiah available at the time. No scroll. I mean, you know, anyway. So, and Philip says, oh, what are you reading? And and the eunuch says, gee, I'm reading this book and I don't understand. Could you explain it to me? And so Philip got in the chariot and explained it to him. And look, as I was growing up in church, the way it was explained, that Philip told him the plan of salvation. If you just believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and accept him as your personal Savior, and the Ethiopian eunuch says, oh my gosh, here's some water. What forbids me from being baptized? And Philip says, let's do it. So they both jump in the water and they baptize him. And it's okay for him to die because he'll go to heaven when he dies because he's been baptized and believes in Jesus. That's what I was taught. Mm-hmm. How narcissistic can you get?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It is a story about somebody who's transgender, mm-hmm. a eunuch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who's a absolutely other. It's just a higher level of acting out of the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Yeah.
Where this poor, Philip is a poor,
yeah,
economically, Jew gets in the same carriage with this rich, really, really different human being who is untouchable.
Wow. That's the baptism right there, right?
It never gets told that way.
Yeah. Well, that will be exciting that you're going to retell it for us.
Well, I'm thinking about it after I talk about the importance of turn signal.
Yes, yeah. Turn signals first, then spiritual practice, then unit.
Got it. You have to have things in their proper order.
That's right.
All right.
All right.
Well, this has been fun.
Yeah.
Watch that movie and tell me next week what you think about it.
I'm a sucker for things about the Holocaust. It's a weird kind of obsession.
I know we're running over, but I went through a phase where I read a ton of books in that, you know, All the Light We Cannot See. The Book Thief.
All so good.
A bunch of other books in that. And it was both so illuminating and so, so discouraging.
I know.
To know that some of the smartest people on the planet, philosophically, mathematically, scientifically, the Germans could do what they did.
Yeah, it is.
And you got it happening in this country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, buddy.
Okay, buddy. Love you.
I love you too. And I'll see you soon.
Sunday.
Okay, bye.
Bye.